Good evening.
The
topic for tonight is the cause of suffering. But before we begin, I would like us to make an aspiration. Let us make the aspiration that we will practice meditation, listen to and study the Dharma, and bring these together and into our lives, so we may awaken all sentient beings from the nightmare of samsara. It's good to make an aspiration at the beginning, and if we do that, then I suppose we have to do a dedication at the end. I know you... Did we do one at the end of the...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, but maybe we can do it again, because... What?
We didn't do the dedication at the end.
We'll do it at the end of this then, okay. Very good. So it's good to make an aspiration at the beginning that we're working for the benefit of all sentient beings, and it's good to then dedicate the merit at the end, and that way we frame the entire evening. So that vow, which is called the Bodhisattva vow, is pretty impossible, isn't it? Because sentient beings are innumerable and we don't even know who we are or who they are or whether we're separate from them or not separate from them. So we have no idea how to do this, but nevertheless we bravely make this aspiration. At the beginning of this course, we started out by saying we all have Buddha nature, or we all are Buddha nature. And the Buddha nature is already in us and only needs to be uncovered. But we really don't understand this. We don't have confidence that that's really the case. We don't have the experience of it, and merely saying it or repeating it isn't all that helpful. The Buddha had this problem. According to the traditional story, he attained supreme awakening while sitting up all night under what has come to be called the Bodhi tree, and he had this realization: I am already awake and enlightened. Everyone else is already awake and enlightened, but they don't know that. And there's no way I could teach that or tell them. So for weeks he just wandered around. He had no idea how to teach. Finally people came to him and said, "You must teach us." And he did teach at that point. What he taught was the very introduction to Buddhism, which we're doing now, called the Four Noble Truths. And the way he did that was not to tell us, sentient beings, us deluded ones, what he already understood, because it would not have helped us. Instead, he spoke to us from our point of view. That is, he said, "Okay, you feel like you have a self, the self has problems, so we're going to talk about the self and its suffering and how to get it out of it." So that's the way we have to talk. I appear to be a self and I'm suffering. We're going to start here, or we did start here last week actually. So for the moment, I'd like to ask you to carry on the conversation in that way. So before we start, take all your theories of what enlightenment might be, all ideas of Buddha nature, all metaphysical ideas. Try to do it. Put it in, we're going to put it into a little ball. And any idea we have about enlightenment, that you've got to squish it down. Hey, please do it. any idea you have about metaphysics or about enlightenment, not being in this body, or any ideas about higher realms or jhana states or formless realms, anything, any theorizing you could do, squish it into this ball, flatten it out, and please put it under here.
We're going to
sit on it. So we only talk from the point of view of we are sentient beings and we have a self as far as we know. So what are the Four Noble Truths? Can some people call it out? First?
There's suffering.
Truth of suffering.
There are causes for suffering.
The truth of the cause of suffering.
Cessation of suffering.
The truth of the cessation of suffering. And the truth of the path. So last week we talked about the truth of suffering. So if you want to know what's going on with me, I'm suffering. I think life is a raw deal. I'm getting old. At some point I'm going to get sick. I'm going to die. There's nothing I can do about it. It seems like I'm here and the world is out there and I'm not in control of it. And also, I didn't really get what I wanted. I wanted to be rich and famous.
Got me. That should count for something.
And that didn't happen. And then things that I didn't want to happen did happen, like my son needing having special needs and so on. So things didn't at all turn out the way I wanted. I didn't get what I wanted, and I got things I didn't want. What is that called?
Suffering.
Complaining.
Complaining.
Kvetching. Kvetching. The suffering of suffering. Anyone want to tell about how they feel about it?
About your suffering?
No, about your suffering. How do you feel, Mary? Tell me. Come on. Okay, not only that, but but that even at the moment things seem to be at least okay, but things will change. Everything is impermanent. I know that if I've got it together, at least somewhat together right now, it's going to fall apart. It won't last very long.
When will Republicans take the Senate? Yeah.
Could get a lot worse, yeah.
You want to talk about suffering. Uh-huh. It's interesting, though. The personal suffering. I do suffer a lot with the political issues, with environmental, you know, with what happens to animals, with species going extinct. At this stage in my life, that causes a huge amount more suffering than, maybe because I don't have that much to complain about personally. That could be, I don't know. But as the older I am, I think the big picture is really affects me a whole lot more.
Right, and that's why some of us are working with this work that reconnects of Joanna Macy, because she points out that the suffering we feel for the world really means that we are bodhisattvas, and that the pain we feel is not personal pain. That pain is means that we're willing to be heroes of the world, bodhisattvas. Anyway, so this suffering of it can't hold out, it's going to things, we can't hold on to things if they're good, even temporarily, they're going to dissolve. What do we call that? The second suffering. First one was the suffering of suffering.
The causes of suffering.
Of change. Things are impermanent, and there's always some basic anxiety in our mind because we know we can't hold it together. And finally, there's all-pervasive suffering. And it's said that it's hard to recognize. Trungpa said that actually we can recognize it. It's hard to recognize because we've been in it so long that we don't realize there's any alternative. So we're like fish swimming through the ocean of samsara, and we don't realize that there could actually be an alternative until we get some glimpse of it. So this is the all-pervasive suffering, that simply being a self is a clunky thing. It's kind of crude, and it takes a lot of maintenance. We keep having to work because we have a self. So those are the three types of suffering. Just to review, does anyone want to say anything about that? Okay, so now we come to the second noble truth, that the cause of suffering. Why did the Buddha teach the cause of suffering? What is the purpose of it? He didn't teach suffering because he wanted to get everyone depressed. Why did he teach the cause of suffering? Is there a reason for it?
Well, if you don't know what causes something, you can't get rid of it. Where it's coming from, you try to just push it away because you don't like it, but that doesn't eliminate it. It just makes it move out of your way for a little bit.
Right. We teach the cause of suffering because if we don't actually understand the cause of suffering, we try to get rid of it in unskillful ways that are very temporary or may make things worse. Punlap Rinpoche, in the very brief discussion we have here, I don't need it, but it's in there. It's not a very long section. And he says, suffering has a cause. If we don't know the cause, then the ways in which we try to get rid of it are unhelpful. In fact, they make things worse. And if we keep trying to get rid of suffering in unskillful ways, and that keeps causing more suffering, that's called the recycling of suffering. And what's the word for that?
Samsara.
Samsara, right. Korwa, samsara. So, according to Buddhist doctrine, the cause of suffering, very succinctly put, is called the twofold veil. Veil meaning a delusion hung over our eyes, something that confuses us and keeps us from seeing clearly. And the twofold veil, two veils, are the veil of delusion, which is thinking and feeling and acting fundamentally as if we are a separate self from the rest of the world and are apart from it. And the second veil, which is actually caused by the first, is called the klesha veil. And klesha is a Sanskrit word, and it has a number of translations and the word conflicted emotion, the phrase conflicted emotion is a reasonably good translation. I prefer that to conflicting emotions or neurotic emotions. There are a whole bunch of words, but I kind of like this translation. Conflicted emotion, klesha. And that's distinguished from wholesome emotions like love, compassion, which are not conflicted.
So are these conflicted emotions like being in conflict, like anger and envy and some of those kinds of things? But anger could be positive, so.
Well, there are positive, there are transformational sides of them, yes, but basically they're conflicted because they drive us in the wrong direction. So the veil of delusion is the root cause, and that gives rise to the klesha veil. But the veil of delusion is very hard to eradicate. It's not something we can easily pull up because we're not even so much aware of it. It's so much in our unconscious that we are separate cells. We don't see an alternative, so it's hard to grapple with that. But the klesha veil is more accessible. So in our meditation practice, we start working with the klesha veil.
Michael?
Yes?
Klesha, as I understand it, individuals have different kleshas.
Individuals,
the klesha veil, mine could be made up of conflicted emotion, different from hers.
Yeah, we all have different mixtures, but we all have some of all of it, too. If I think that I'm mainly angry, but I'm free of greed, it turns out not to be the case, or that I'm free of envy, or other emotions. It turns out that we all have all of them, but different people have different habitual ways in which they dwell more often than other ways. Is that?
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay, you're thinking that people sort of specialize?
That certain... I guess a klesha was anything that could get you all riled up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we need to deal with that then.
So, and I don't mean angry necessarily, but that person, just the way that person talks, just not, you know. And that is my thing that's not... But yeah, I guess you're right. It's different. It's maybe our same emotional reactions, but different things set us off. Maybe that's what I'm trying to say. Buttons. Yeah, we all have different buttons that get pushed.
Okay, so we have different tendencies in terms of buttons that get pushed,
right,
or demons that erupt from inside us, okay?
Right.
But those demons that come up suddenly and unexpectedly are merely a visible hunk of a huge amount that's not so visible. And the submerged part is more important. That is, not that we can see disruptions. We see people doing crazy things, shooting someone because they're angry, or robbing a bank because they're greedy for money, or whatever. But we all have a level of all of those going within us. And it's something we can see. That is, this is what we're talking about here is not a theory. It's something to put into practice, to work with your meditation on. So we're going to picture this as a tree. Now, we all have different images of trees. I know there's one back there which we all like. And maybe when we get to the cessation of suffering, we'll find the trees that are not samsaric trees, but this is a samsaric tree. This is the tree of our negativity, of our suffering. So this tree has roots which are the veil of delusion that we're a separate self. And those roots are hard for us to see because they're buried deep in the ground. Any discussion like that, this of course is a metaphor, and all metaphors eventually run their limits and have to be gone beyond, but it's a pretty useful one. So what we can see coming out of the ground are some big branches, and the three big branches coming out, which are called the three poisons, are sometimes referred to as passion, aggression, and ignorance, the three primary negative emotions. But here, passion does not mean a genuine passion to grab something. It doesn't mean a genuine passion to make love or a genuine passion to help people or something. What we're talking about here is attachment, that is, taking the passion to be mine and wanting to hold it. And the second one is called aggression, but it's sometimes called aversion, because again, there could be a anger which goes beyond the self, but here we're talking about I want to hold on to my anger. It's mine. And the third one is called ignorance, not the primordial delusion, but the ignorance of not wanting to pay attention to something. So basically these are, in a sense, strategies. We want to go grab it and take it in. It's mine. We want to push it away. It's not mine. Or I'm just going to pretend it isn't there. These are the three poisons, sometimes called passion, aggression, and ignorance. It would be good to ask questions about this before going on. Does this seem unreasonable?
No, I think it's not a question, but just wanted to tell you, in Tibetan, the three poisons that we kind of metaphorically refer it as attachment to a bird or a dog, because they have a level of warmth or something that you know, the symbolic thing that we refer to, and aggression as snake, and ignorance as ick.
Maybe we'll bring in we could bring in the painting that shows those in the center. Mm-hmm.
Wheel of Samsara.
The Wheel of Samsara is called Wheel of Korwa. Those three animals again are the.
Well, sometimes we see it as a peacock, right? Or a rooster.
Rooster. Yeah. Passion. Aggression is a snake, and a pig is the ignoring or ignorance. Yeah. However, these give rise to further. This tree branches, so we get into greed, envy, pride, and if you want to, you can start probably cataloging finer aspects of negative emotion.
So Michael, with the aggression, you're saying that it's the wanting to hold on to it as opposed to aggression itself or anger? I'm just unclear about that.
There's a possibility of a pure anger, which is an anger purely in a situation that's not about me or wanting to hold on to me. It's just an expression of what has to be expressed, okay?
Okay.
It's without a certain amount of wisdom, it's pretty dangerous to say that's what I'm doing.
So it's not about your ego.
It's not about your ego.
But the aggression is more about your ego.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we can delude ourselves in thinking this is not about my ego when it really is. That is, there's lots of forms of delusion on the path, so we have to keep becoming more and more subtle in the sense of awareness of our own tendencies. Mm-hmm. Because the last thing we want to do is to be enlightened. That's death of the ego. We don't want that. So then,
I see some questions.
Yes, sorry. Did I miss them?
Just what I'm...
Question. Comment. Declaration.
Is it fair to say that there are like an infinite number of expressions of these three poisons? But on the other side, is there an infinite number of expressions of, I don't know, goodness or things that lead... phenomena that leads towards enlightenment?
Yeah, but we're going to have to wait on that because we're sitting on it. But, but the answer has to be yes, of course. Enlightenment is not a boring uniformity. It's full of energy and action and events and so on. But yeah.
Well, if I could just make one follow-up. The reason is I'm always mystified by the notion that you know, there may be an infinite number of positive ways of doing things. I get you must do it my way, our way, or this way, or the proven way, and yet there's an infinite number of ways to do it that will succeed.
Well, my
so
way,
you keep
yeah.
that in the back of your mind, I like an answer to
it. Well, my way isn't exactly free of ego, is it?
Hmm?
My way, my truth isn't exactly free of ego, is it? You better accept my truth.
It'll make me feel worse if you don't.
It's obviously, until we are really free of it, there's a little impurity in it, right?
Yes, but I'm looking for the ones that don't.
Okay, well.
So if you can give some insight there.
Yeah, when we get to the third turning, we can sort of say hallelujah.
Thank you.
Okay, so we got this tree, and it has leaves on it, and the leaves are discursive thoughts. So the emotions are all about me. They're all about my anger, my greed, my whatever. And then we put our mind into thinking about it, so we got thoughts. So Buddhists love to make catalogs. And last week Michael talked about cataloging these thoughts into categories. And there were eight of them coming in pairs. Can you remember them? Or some of them? There were eight. There are eight pairs of... Four pairs, total of eight.
Eight worldly dharmas we talked about.
These are the leaves of the trees, of the tree.
Hate, but I forget what it goes with. Hate?
No, it's an emotion, but yeah.
No.
Okay, there's pleasure and pain.
Anxiety.
What?
Anxiety.
Well, anxiety is sort of an underlying thing. There's, aside from pain and pleasure...
dread or...
Gain and loss.
Gain and loss.
Gain and loss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Praise and blame.
Yeah, I really want to be... I don't want to be blamed for that. I want praise. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of how I got blamed for it and it wasn't fair, and that's my thought coming up, right?
Hope and fear? No.
Well, that's more underlying.
That's what the whole thing is. You're expressing it in either pleasure, pain.
Okay. Fame and insignificance.
Yeah, fame and not being recognized, right. Mm-hmm. So as I say, I didn't manage to get rich and famous, so there's two of them. Okay, so...
What was it?
Pleasure and pain.
Pleasure and pain.
They're actually on an outline sheet that...
Michael's notes.
Yeah.
They're in his notes from online, the PDF.
And it was handed out last week. Yeah.
No, it wasn't handed out.
No? Okay. But it's there now. So it doesn't matter whether we catalog them or don't catalog them, but because we have the underlying quality of our conflicted emotions, our thoughts are all about me in one way or another. They're about the gain I want to get, the pain I want to avoid, the blame I want to avoid, the whatever. Can we see that in our meditation? What do we do when we meditate? Why do we use the breath? Okay, the instruction is we use the breath so we don't mindlessly drift, right? So it's putting up some sort of a watchdog. So we have some sort of mindfulness of what our mind is doing as opposed to mindfulness of traffic conditions or something else. So that's what we do just when we're meditating. We follow the breath as a technique. It's not mystical. It's not to turn us into some happy state or hypnotize us. It's a technique for interrupting our drift so that we keep coming back to being here. And what is it when we're not here, what is it we're doing?
Any worrying.
Thinking. We've got some thought, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we get a chance to see our thoughts, right? And if we keep doing this, they get kind of boring, don't they? In other words, the meditation itself is kind of boring because you can say, oh, I've got one of these. I've got one of these. I've got one of these. Maybe there's only eight of them. Who knows? Maybe that's not the way you catalog it. It doesn't matter. But you start to recognize what your mind is doing and how habitual it is. So that's the first step, is that we can start with the leaves of this tree. We can't start by tearing up the tree. So it's a gentle, gradual approach. And actually, in the third and fourth sections of this yellow booklet, there's more work on the next step after that, which is emotions. In fact, there's two whole chapters on that. So, excuse me, we have a chance to get back to that. So that's really what today's message is. We can discuss this. We have the cause of suffering is a twofold veil. The fundamental one, which is that we're deluded because we take ourselves to be separate entities from the world, so that we have self and other. And from that arises conflicted emotions and all the thoughts that are energized by the conflicted emotions.
How can we reconcile this fact that we're a part of the universe when we're also shut in to ourselves? Like, you know, there's always a limit of how much we can communicate with other people and other living things. And so that kind of gives us, that's what feeds our notion of being separate from the universe and kind of us versus them.
Yeah, that's the key question. I don't know that I can answer in its totality, but I think it gets answered gradually along the path. That is, our mind can see through it and can see, starting with little glimpses, that it's actually not the case. Logically, it's not the case. Logically, we're just, it's a reaction going on, and maybe it's inside this body, maybe it's not, but everything that happens is a mixture of all kinds of things on the outside and all kinds of things on the inside. And the world is more flowing through us so that we can not be so completely tied down. It's not that we're going to, it's not that anything's going to go away. It's that we're going to see it differently. But right now, if we can't do that, or we can't do it very well, then the thing to do is to ask, why can't we do it? That's always a good strategy for Buddhists. The path is, if I can't be enlightened, instead of saying, oh, I want to leap and do it instantly, we say, well, why can't I be enlightened? Let's take a look at what's happening and let's see how deep we can go into it and keep going deeper into it. So that's what the path is. And we start with thoughts and we go into emotions and we keep working at that.
Is it harder to see that we don't have a self when we, like now we live in this country, in this age where you have this vision, like you have to ignore the fact that all the stuff you get somebody else made for you, because but you don't have to see those people. You know, hundreds of years ago, if I needed food, I had to see the people who actually made the food. Now I go to the store and I, you know, there's sort of this... I'm not connected to a lot of stuff.
And alienation.
Alienation. And I can feel like I don't need other people because I take care of myself. And that's kind of what America has, this sort of like individual bit. And so is that... I mean, clearly it was true 3,000 years ago. But is it more now or is it just different?
Well... the way we've sort of massified everything kind of does make it more true, because everyone was alienated 3,000 years ago, but they weren't alienated so together as we are. You know, everybody is waiting to get on the bus, and they all have the same goal, but it's not a goal together. You know, everyone is sort of alienated, pushed together in these close, confined spaces now, and it seems like that kind of... accentuates it.
Yeah, I think so. Alienation is a fairly modern term. I don't think it's more than probably less than 200 years old, right? So, yeah, I think that in the traditional countries where Buddhism developed, they were more confronted with everything in their environment, and therefore not quite as detached from it.
And I mean, I think it's an illusion, this whole, I mean, it's an illusion that we're so independent, because we actually are extremely dependent on a lot of people that we don't know. You know, on a daily basis, we're dependent on so many people that are, like, faceless. And that's kind of, I think there's a part of ourselves that realizes that, and that provokes anxiety as well. That you actually are, even though you're supposed to foster this illusion that you're independent, like, you know, I don't know how to build my own house anymore. I don't know how to do any of these things for myself. I have to get somebody else to do them for me, and I don't even know who that person is. I don't know.
Right, and there's that ignorance which is actually sponsored and paid for with money. That is, we should be ignorant of the conditions of pigs in a feedlot. And any attempt to simply... not even to do anything in particular, but just to be aware of it, there's a whole industry that wants to make sure that that doesn't happen, and they're willing to spend a lot of money to make sure that it doesn't happen.
And I feel like that's kind of new, too, because, right. Like, 200 years ago, it's like, yeah, life sucks for poor people, but we were so, like, openly hostile toward them that it was like, ah, oh, whatever. And now we've kind of inserted this middleman to sort of put that smoke and mirrors in it.
They always had a middleman. They've always had some hierarchy, some kind of controlling hierarchy that basically gave people enough to believe in that allowed them, like carrots on a stick, you know, to keep them
going.
I mean, this is not new. Actually, these situations are not different from when they have. This is the human condition. We have been experiencing this kind of problem. Even the word alienation, even though it reflects a particular kind of experience that has developed recently, in a traditional society, if you were alienated, you were out. I mean,
yeah.
That was like death. You know, that was like, that's why Socrates drank the hemlock. He didn't leave. He did not leave because he would have had to leave the society, and he would be out in for that world of Greek society. That was death. That was equivalent to death.
But I think that living in a continuous alienation is a somewhat new experience, and that we do need some somewhat different approaches to some of our understanding in order to deal with that, because it's not visible. In other words, it's more a universal condition in which we go around like zombies.
And suppose even if you are not ignorant to like the way our livestock is treated, or the fact that all of our clothing is made by people in other parts of the world that are paying less, then, you know, because how do you free yourself from that, though? Because it's so part of our system that, like, every store you go to, everything you buy is part ingrained into that. So once you try to not be ignorant of it, then how do you get past that?
So it's painful.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying is, like, I guess sometimes, you know, you may not be ignorant about it, but then it's like it's too much suffering to handle, so you kind of become apathetic or cynical or indifferent, just because what do you feel like there's no escape from it.
So I believe that we are training in not being ignorant of suffering. In other words, taking all the suffering that we see and that we see for ourselves and that we see in the world, and uncovering it. And that's an important aspect of working with the truth of suffering. I really believe that. And it's an important aspect of planetary consciousness, that we don't lose track of it, that we see it and feel it. Yeah, anyway.
How do you balance off gratitude with the suffering? Does that come into play?
Does anyone else want to answer it?
Well, isn't that the reason for joy? Is that we suffer? I mean, if you're having fun all the time, you're not really having fun, are you? If you love everything, you don't really love anything, right?
No, but I'm talking about to awaken to the truth of suffering. The other side of that coin is being grateful for what is working, and it's not putting your head in the sand. It's not saying, oh, I only see, you know, the sky is blue.
Right. So,
the balance of the two.
I don't know if it's the balance as holding them simultaneously. It's not that we do so much of one, so much of the other. There's a traditional bringing our mind to the Dharma, which starts with joyful to have such a human life, difficult to find, free and well-favored. So it starts with joy, and then it comes to the suffering. But death is real and comes without warning. This body will be a corpse. So we start with the fact that we're alive, and even more the fact that we actually have wakefulness, which is what joyful to have such a free and well-favored life. That means that we actually have some leisure to have a spiritual practice and to awaken. So that's a very joyful condition, and it precedes the looking at the suffering. It also precedes it in the work that reconnects that I'm working with right now, incidentally.
So, in the in this Joanna Macy work, the first piece of it is gratitude. And then you move to acknowledging your pain for the suffering of the earth, for the earth, and then sort of move to how do you do something about it. So I think the importance of the gratitude is if we didn't think there was really good stuff, then the suffering would just be horrible. I mean, then that would be, exactly. Why bother? If oh, there's suffering and that's it. Everything really does suck, like Mike started out with.
except for
he didn't acknowledge that.
He never agreed. I didn't hear it.
So, I mean, I think that's the piece, that if there wasn't that joy, that's the reason to say, you know, there is some place to get to.
Yes.
Right.
But the joy is, but the joy is even more fundamental. Just the awakeness of having mind when we go beyond the hassles. It is joyful that we're having a mind, even if we're at this moment dying of cancer. Being awake in this world is fundamentally joyful. And that teaching does come before suffering. So perhaps I was being a bit extreme in saying we've just got to start with the Four Noble Truths. You start with suffering. But it's fine to have a preamble. And we did give you a little preamble.
I feel like it also, if you stare at the things that you really dislike and hate and right in the face long enough, you kind of start to love them. You know, you kind of like start to find some beauty in them, and then it becomes worth it.
There,
and vice versa.
Yeah, the remarkable experiences of overcoming what you think is a situation of enmity, which is unresolvable, and finding that it isn't when our minds open.
I just don't know, but if you can Google His Holiness Dalai Lama's words on precious human life, it says that every morning as you wake up, be thankful that you are alive, you have another human life, you know. So that kind of, I think, will help you in, you know, the kind of a relief from the problems that you see a big problem, you have a big trouble, but, you know, your life is more precious than the problem that you're concerned with. If you can just Google and go through this little kind of verse, I think you have a precious human life.
Excuse me.
Bless you.
Getting back to the meditation question, though, I mean, it's all what we kind of discuss and think and analyze to some extent. But when you're meditating, you can't do that. you look at your thoughts, and you also a lot more often I find some of the more personal. You know, you might your mind might bring a conversation to you that you had that day or yesterday, and then you start, then it starts another, a whole conversation going on. It's like, where did that come from? And but you don't dwell on it, you just let it go.
Okay,
and then sometimes I think, to what end?
Okay, that's good. We're going to get into that a little bit. Yeah, did you want to add to that?
No, I was just, yeah, I mean, that, what I've heard is to let it go, kind of like a cloud. You just
Well,
yeah,
yeah, but I want to stick with this, okay?
Yeah.
So if you want to add to or provide insight about this, then that's fine. Okay, so there is contemplation and there is meditation, and contemplation is a place where you can take your Dharma question and explore it and use your mind to go into it, to drill into the question, is this really the case? Why do I feel this way? What is behind it? Not in a psychoanalytic way, like, well, I'm doing this because when I was a kid, my mom said, but this comes up with a certain feeling, and I see that this feeling comes up in this context, and this is the way my mind operates. So we can use contemplation to do that. And it's valuable if we're going to do contemplation and meditation to put boundaries on them. In other words, now I'm contemplating, now I'm meditating. Uh-huh. In other areas of our life, we would certainly do that. We wouldn't say, now I'm working on American history, now I'm working on calculus, as opposed to sitting down and having some mishmash of them. Mm-hmm. So it's actually good to do contemplation and meditation as things with sharp boundaries.
Okay. There are three aspects of that, what we call them in Dharma: learning, contemplating, and meditating. I didn't know
we talked about that before, that was in the introduction I gave briefly,
but those are the three kind of dynamics of practice. Each of them are actually considered a part of the practice. Okay. Learning and studying the Dharma, and learning, and then actually contemplating it so that you can actually begin to see how it might work, and meditating, actually bringing it to bear in terms of your direct practice.
Well, that meditation gives you a lot to contemplate.
Yes.
So does life.
Yeah. Is this the order we're supposed to do it in, contemplating? And then, I have a really hard time not contemplating while I'm meditating. To think I let the thoughts all go on, but that's
okay. But
are we supposed to contemplate for 10 minutes and then meditate for 10 minutes, or for 10 minutes and then contemplate?
We haven't given any instructions We haven't given any instructions up front here, other than meditation instruction.
Right.
We have not given. Other than when we taught Tonglen, which is a form of contemplation, okay?
But I'm wondering what is... I guess I'm asking for...
Well, it's possible...
Some recommendations. Yeah.
It's possible to contemplate and meditate. It's possible to meditate, put the contemplation in the middle, and then meditate again. This is why we actually suggest that you make use of a meditation instructor, because it's not really, it's going to vary depending upon your needs and what point you are in and what you're feeling. So it actually helps to have a private discussion of this, which is what we keep trying to ask people to do.
It can be more confusing if you're just mixing them all up and sticking the contemplation in the middle. You can use it as a crutch, because you can say, I'm going to meditate for 10 minutes, but thank God I'm going to finish that and get to do something else, and then just let my mind wander for 10 minutes. So I think we are really emphasizing meditation as a practice and learning to settle your mind and be able to understand what your mind is doing. And we're not emphasizing contemplation. That is another practice, and there are contemplations that actually help you to, for instance, realize, what is this self made of in your mind? And that helps to penetrate, too, through to the truth. So we aren't really teaching that yet, but go ahead.
So you are teaching, though, so we're learning. We're doing the learning part. And we're doing the meditation part.
Right.
But I'm hearing you say...
Well, there's two different things.
But we're not supposed to
be contemplating. No, you should be... When you can read a book, you can look at this book instead of just reading it and then walking away and waiting for class. And that can be a contemplation, but you wouldn't be meditating on that. You would actually be asking yourself, well, what is the origin of suffering? What does that mean to me? But that's not within the context of your meditation practice, is what I'm saying. So you're hearing the Dharma, contemplating on what it means to you and bringing up those questions for yourself and asking yourself, well, what does this mean? And the meditation technique we're teaching is the shamatha vipassana practice. Does that help at all, or is that confusing?
Are you asking, Roberta, like, if I have an hour a day to do all these great things, what order should I do them?
You do your Dharma study as a contemplation, sitting on the cushion then.
But you could do them, I mean, you could do one of them in the morning, one at lunch, and one at dinner, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to.
Or 15 minutes of one and 15 mm-hmm. minutes of another. There's lots of ways to do it, yeah.
Well, I'm lucky if I can get to 15 minutes of meditation.
Right.
That's, to do some reading. But I guess I'm confused.
But I think when you read, you contemplate. Like, unless you just read word, you read it, and then you say, wow.
Well, I think the stuff I notice when I'm meditating, though, it's hard not to contemplate about that.
Right.
Okay.
I notice all this gigantic anger about all this stuff and these people. And so.
Well, you're noticing, and then you don't have to dwell on it or analyze it during the meditation.
But, I just...
You're noticing. That's you're touching and letting go.
Yeah, I guess I do. I try not to contemplate, but I do anyway.
Okay.
But then I do think about it.
Then give yourself time. Then give yourself time to contemplate.
Yeah, you can think about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You're
allowed to do that.
You're allowed to do anything.
Yeah. Watch yourself, though.
Watch. See what.
What I really hope to see is a lot of inquisitiveness about everything that we could possibly say. And I'd much rather be given a hard time, really, because you are contemplating.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
I'm Eddie from not Cambridge, Lace Curtain Irish meditator. When I meditate or when I practice, I try to achieve a conscious state of emptiness called trance, if you will, And we have six senses that we have to count. And I say six because one of them is, it's questionable, but the sight, the sound, the smell, the touch, the taste, and the other one, I guess, is inertia, because if you're in an elevator and you're not moving, but you know you're moving, that's a sense that you have. So you have to calm those senses in order to get to open yourself up to the transcendental senses, or so that you get transcendental awareness. And I think there's a term called Kundalini. That's the inner energy you're trying to tap into.
Okay, that's different than what we teach here.
And,
but I'm not going to say it's wrong, but it's not what we teach here.
Well, I don't know what, I'm very early in this, attempted awareness. I'm wearing a...
Well, you don't have to be converted. You can stick with what you have.
Well, I'm converted. I know there's something on the other side, because 7 weeks ago I was dead, lying on a, in a hospital emergency room, and I was no heart, no pulse, no breath, and they're keeping a close watch on me with external defibrillator, and I have the Victoria's Secret bra from Helen Delacate. So this type of enlightenment, has become, tantamount, to me, because, there's something there. And I'm trying to scoop it all in, when I hear the discussion, I say, I think I can buy into that, or I think that means something.
Okay, but if you don't want to, don't.
It's all so new. It's also, according to one of the self-help gurus who I listened to and I enjoyed his CDs, is the matrix of awareness. There's four ways. You don't know that you don't know, and then you don't know that you know, and then you know that you don't know, and you know that you know, and somewhere in that matrix, I'm trying to put my little my little ball was to make it stick in that.
You didn't run into Don Rumsfeld, did you?
I think this fool's name was Kevin Trudeau. But yeah, that's why I'm listening and I'll be totally amazed before I'm halfway through.
Okay, well, thank you. So I wanted to, if we're done with this for the moment, I wanted to say something which is simply motivational for next week, to give you a little bit to chew on. So if we're going to follow the Dharma, which means the teachings and the meditation practice, and go along with this, there has to be, in some sense, a provisional trust in the teacher, the boss teacher who we follow, and in us junior teachers, and in the Dharma itself. Not a belief, we're not trying to get anyone to believe, but a provisional trust means that it could be a good direction to go in, okay? Like if you meet someone on the street because you have to say, how do I get to Central Square, and that person says, well, you go this way and you go two blocks. You've got to decide whether or not you trust that person enough to try it, okay? It's not a belief, but it's, do I think that there's going to be something worth it here? So what I want to say is that as far as we know, we are not leading you on a path towards dysfunctionality. We are not leading you on a path of shutting down any part of your life, including your senses. We're not leading you towards a way of giving up whatever makes life enjoyable to you and just attaining some sort of neutrality. And very importantly, we're not deprecating intelligence and perception. We're not deprecating intelligence and perception. And one might think that we are going that way, and the reason is because the more you hear the language of Dharma, the more you hear things like non-thought and beyond conceptual mind. We hear these again and again, right? And we might think that that means I'm not supposed to think, I'm not supposed to use my intelligence. And that is definitely not the case. We need our intelligence, and we need to energize it, and we need to get vigorous with it and curious with it if we're going to go anywhere with Dharma. So there is a way to work with that, which is what I want to work with next week. And the problem is not our intelligence and our perception, but the problem is that they get hijacked by the two veils. That is, they get hijacked into the ignorance of believing in a self. They get hijacked into serving the kleshas. So there's a story about how our intelligence and perception gets hijacked, and it's a good thing to understand this story, because if we understand this story, we can start to liberate it. And the name of this story is the five skandhas, and skandha is a Sanskrit word meaning heap, and it's simply a way of analyzing, it's not a theory of perception or intelligence, it's a story, at least the way I'm going to present it and the way my teacher presented it. It's the story of how our intelligence gets hijacked. So if we start to learn that, then we have a chance of freeing our intelligence to work better for us in all sorts of ways. So next week we're going to talk about the five skandhas, which, if I can pronounce it right, would be Pungpa. Is that right? Pungpa Nga. No?
Pungpa.
Yeah. What does that mean? Is that something familiar to you? Pung pa ha? Five heaps?
Yeah, pung is the collection.
Collection, that's yeah. Collection. Okay, the five collections?
Yeah.
And you've heard that, right?
Not really.
No? Okay. Anyway, in Sanskrit it's skanda. So next week we will talk about the five skandhas, the story of how our intelligence gets hijacked. So now we should dedicate the merit.
Okay.